Well, thank you so much, Anna. Thank you, everyone. It's a treat and an honor to be here and to catch at least a little bit of this wonderful seminar that you're running this term on Themistius. I've learned a lot already from Franz de Haas's talk last week, and I only regret that I missed Richard's romp through Themistius a little earlier, which I know must have been an absolute treat. Neil gave us, for those who happened to be at the launch of the Causation and Creation book, this lovely metaphor to think about the relationship between philosophy and history, where we had philosophy up the mountain and I think history down on the plains, so to speak. So I think this talk will be relatively close to the plains. I'd like to try to keep it relatively close to the plains, but there's a little bit of spelunking on the mountainside towards the end. This seminar seems tailor-made for the discussion of Themistius, I think. His life was lived at the intersection of public affairs and philosophy in the 4th century, and he, to some extent like us, struggled to join those two currents in a way that held meaning for him. Early in his life, according to Themistius' own account in Oration 23, the circulation of his paraphrases of Aristotle attracted a fairly diverse and international group of students. He may have parlayed that success into a teaching career at Constantinople, and then in 350 delivered an extraordinarily successful oration on philanthropy to the emperor, Constantius II, in which he transparently personified the honest and independent-minded philosopher exercising parrhesia, or freedom of speech, in address to a king, and made no bones about it, as text 1 on the handout illustrates. "Now, for the first time, your majesty, there comes on the scene for you both an independent speech and a truthful praise-giver, and there is no word, however insignificant, that he would utter of his own free will, for which he shall not render account to philosophy." 5 years later, in 355, Constantius had elected Themistius to the Senate of Constantinople, launching a career of public service and imperial engagement that would reach into the 380s, when Themistius briefly served as prefect of the city under Theodosius. Between those decades, he would advise emperors, tutor their children, and speak both for the Senate of Constantinople, as he says in Oration 16, and for philosophy herself, as he implies in Orations 5, 6, and 34. The participation of the emperor's philosopher in state business came to carry something of a talismanic property, as Peter Heather put it, who I think is here next week, in fact, attracting elite support by stamping policies with the seal of Hellenic paideia. The emperor's philosopher, already a dilemma. Themistius was often obliged to explain how a philosopher could be active in public life, caught up in a network of international affairs and patronage, without betraying the indispensable values of uncompromising independence, honesty, modest living, and freedom of speech that had catapulted him to fame in the first place. Like his contemporaries, modern scholars have often been skeptical. Text 2 is an example of that skepticism. Set in context, Themistius' speeches and Libanius' letters allow us to penetrate some way beyond the bland facade of the truth-telling, independent philosopher which their author so carefully erected. A little gentle probing reveals the determined careerist with an interesting rhetorical angle to exploit in the fact that, as a philosopher, he had to tell the truth. As we'll find a little later on, Themistius goes to a great deal of trouble to show that this view has it backwards. He's really a philosopher using rhetoric to achieve philosophical ends, not a rhetorician using philosophy. He works hard to define and resituate the image of philosophy in such a way that it will embrace his public activities, for example, in Oration 21. But Themistius is also tricky to study as a philosopher. His paraphrases, of course, convey a great deal of philosophical interest. Last week we talked about some of his creative and subtle reflection on Aristotle's active intellect. But those paraphrases, Themistius says, were works of my youth in Oration 23. He even claims in an oration that the paraphrases were relatively unoriginal workings up of his father Eugenius's views, although some passages in the paraphrases themselves, for example on the Posterior Analytics, suggest that he did think carefully and originally about their construction. At any rate, most of Themistius's mature self-expression is preserved for us through his orations, both what we've called, I think, since Schenkel, his public or politikos orations and his private or idiotikos orations, and we philosophers nowadays are not necessarily disposed to penetrate rhetorical self-fashioning and the twists and turns of an identity reshaped for different audiences over decades. As a public intellectual, Themistius is rather wiggly. When he offers a history of philosophy, for example, it varies with the needs of the oration, as between oration 26 and 34. When he launches a rip-roaring assault on sophists in Constantinople, in one speech, he returns to the stage a little later to clarify that, of course, he didn't mean those sophists, the friends he'll be having to dinner on the weekend. In the process, he revises quite thoroughly his carefully worked out genus and species definition of sophistry. So it seems sort of hopeless to interrogate these texts for Themistius's considered view, say, of the history or essence of philosophy. That just seems like the wrong kind of question to ask of him. But the really difficult and interesting wiggling happens around Themistius's interpretation of philosophy, so to speak, his metaphilosophical views, what a philosopher is and what a philosopher's virtue or arete really amounts to. This question lies at the intersection, of course, of his rhetorical and philosophical projects, and the paper I'd like to share today is basically a survey of Themistius's rhetorically fashioned image of the philosopher. So in part one, I'd like to briefly review how Themistius cultivates the image of a virtuous guardian of Paideia and practitioner of Parrhasia, according to the image of the philosopher current in the 4th century. In part two, I'd like to look at the defensive shield that he raises when this image comes under attack or scrutiny, namely how he positively reframes and resituates the practice of philosophy in order to capture his public activities as properly belonging to it. In part three, I'd like to look at how Themistius counterattacks. In a sense, if part two looks at the shield, part three looks at the sword, how he negatively depicts the kind of philosophy that he implies is practiced by his critics. Here, there's a fairly pervasive consensus that Themistius means to criticize contemporary Neoplatonists, contemplatives, devotees of the perhaps competing image of the Iamblichian late antique holy man. But I'd like to suggest that Neoplatonists may not, in fact, be the target of Themistius's rhetorical rebuttal. And then finally, in part four, I'll try to sum up some of what I've suggested and what we've learned. So to begin with part one, how Themistius portrays himself as belonging to the identity of the 4th century philosopher. Themistius's public success and his vaunted imperial favor rested on his charismatic capacity to evince the character and identity of a philosopher in his speeches and in his comportment. He maintains that identity, I think, with striking consistency through 30 years and the reign of five odd emperors. From the beginning in the oration to Constantius that made his career, Themistius hangs his hat on the characteristics that the philosopher's brand and history demand of him: objectivity, lack of distortion, freedom of speech to power, and unswerving loyalty to the truth. His image was so familiar, in fact, that one emperor, Julian, wryly makes fun of him for it, teases him a little bit. So it was well known. The character that Themistius laid public claim to is very nicely summarized by Peter Brown in a well-known passage of Power and Persuasion, which is passage 3 on the handout. The philosopher was someone who was held to owe nothing to ties of patronage and friendship. He was a man who, by a heroic effort of his mind, had found freedom from society. For that reason, he carried his right to parrhasia in his own person. He could address the great directly in terms of a code of decorum and self-restraint that he himself exemplified to the highest degree. The tranquil, bearded figure of the philosopher, with bare chest and simple cloak, carrying a leather satchel and a staff, owing nothing to any man, brought to his task certain carefully nurtured virtues: carteria, or endurance; parrhasia, candid speech and good counsel offered without fear or favor, an infinitely precious social elixir. As Robin Lane Fox later put it, this ideal philosopher could speak out and persuade even rulers ravaged by the wild beasts of anger and passion, because he himself had mastered the beasts of passion within. This is, of course, an echo of Thumos and Epithumia in Plato's Republic. The philosopher had, so to speak, won the right to independence from outward tyranny because he had conquered the tyrants within. Themistius wears the philosopher's tribonion, the sort of threadbare cloak, when he travels and dines with Constantius. He declines the financial benefits, the grain allowance that go with his appointment as a proconsul. So he tries outwardly to lay claim to just this kind of image. He occasionally uses the abstract noun philosophy, philosophia, to designate himself in orations 5, 6, and 34, for example, and stresses that this philosophy just is insightful truth-telling in orations 1, 3, 5, 16, 34, just about everywhere. So in a sense, Themistius just is the truth personified, just as he often declares the emperor the living or personified law. He offers direct advice and demonstrates plain parrhesia even to the emperor Valens, who is apparently a bit of a drip, who is always on the alert to detect personal advantage behind every seemingly public-spirited request. But Themistius frequently faced criticism for accepting public office and for gathering large crowds, both of which were an uneasy fit for his philosophical identity. In one case, echoing the trial of Socrates, modestly, he portrays himself as a legal defendant before these sort of shadowy accusers. An example of this is text 4 on the handout. "You must hear read to you again, as in a court of law," he says, probably to a relatively small crowd of fairly well-to-do people. He mentions that some of them considered themselves philosophers and some of them were emphrones, rather thoughtful, reflective people. "You must hear read to you again the sworn statement of accusation that these clever plaintiffs and artificers of silence lodge against me. He's committing an injustice, they say, through his philosophical innovation and his introduction of new deities. For he does not sit quietly in his room and converse solely with his pupils. Instead, he comes out into the public arena, does not hesitate to appear in the very heart of the city, and ventures to speak before all sorts of people. And as serious as this is, still it's not the worst of it. Now he even gathers audiences. For 3 successive days, summons people to court, lets himself be commended, and canvasses his applauders. What other indications and evidence could you possibly need that the gentleman is a sophist, since you see the chair and platform, the stolen goods, that are proof of his crime?" And all through his career, Themistius' response to these and similar accusations, which seem to have continually cropped up, was fairly consistent. There are really 3 parts to it. First, he resituates any criticism of his motives or public behavior as if it was really a critique of publicly engaged philosophy in general. Then, second, he proves that publicly engaged philosophy is really as old as the hills, and claims Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle as its authorizing fathers. Finally, he turns the tables on his accusers, taking them to task for distinguishing and endorsing, however implicitly, the contrary, an inactive and unsocial philosophy that chops logic in secluded corners while ignoring the public good. This charge may not be entirely unfamiliar today. Themistius' typical move is plain, for example, in an explanation he offers to his fellow senators in Constantinople, which is text 5 on the handout. Autobiographically, he says, "I followed the most highly regarded of the ancient philosophers, who explain that there are 2 philosophical paths, one that is more concerned with divine matters, and a second that is more useful in public affairs. I chose the kind of philosophy that is beneficial to you over that which investigates only what concerns me personally. I elected the kind of philosophy that operates in the public arena. In so doing, I followed the example of Socrates and Aristotle and their predecessors, the celebrated 7 wise men, who, by combining deeds, erga, with their words, logoi, showed us a kind of philosophy that is neither inactive nor useless to society." Throughout his career, Themistius presents himself as just this sort of politikos philosophos, a civic philosopher or statesman, who aimed to secure what was good for his city. He hoped that he would be regarded as a statesman, a politikos, really in the Platonic sense of that word, as he says in Oration 26. And underwriting this, as several orations and fragments show, is his commitment to what he calls the practical and political philosophy of Aristotle, as in Oration 34, when he mentions his approval of Aristotle's recognition of the social and political nature of the human being. He also maintains a lesson that he says he learned from his father. Philosophy should not be subordinated to rhetoric, but rhetoric should always serve the ends of philosophy. So for the next 2 parts of the paper, I'd like to turn to Themistius' defensive and offensive image making, the shield and the sword, so to speak. First, the shield. He takes control of both the image of the philosopher and that of the sophist, tutoring the public and his detractors, and emphasizing a kind of positive message about philosophy, that civic-minded or public-spirited behavior has been part of its pedigree and project from the beginning. And then the sword. He counterattacks against his critics, suggesting, though more gently, that it's them who really betray philosophy by keeping silent and refusing to get entangled in public life, to say nothing of those who indulge in slander. So coming to part 2, Themistius's defense. I'd like to start with a few examples of Themistius's defensive tactics. Oration 21, which is incidentally a blockbuster oratorical tour de force, is directed at the criticism that Themistius is a blockbuster orator. It begins rather disarmingly. And this is text 6 on the handout. All you gentlemen whom I have brought together today in the theater of the muses, why do you sit here in a state of shock? Why are you so amazed? I don't know, Themistius, because you're wonderful. Surely now it does not seem peculiar and strange to you that a man who is considered worthy of being called a philosopher was seen yesterday gathering an audience. Surely it does not seem strange to you that today he is seen seated in a very sophistical and pompous manner on a lofty chair. But I do not consider myself a philosopher. First, Themistius ironically denies the title of the philosopher. Sometimes this hasn't been read as ironic, but I think it clearly is as we read on. His father, Eugenius, was a genuine philosopher, he points out, but he's not as sharp as his father. In fact, he was a rather bad, dull, slow student, and sometimes his father got fed up with him, he says. And he doesn't lay claim to the high title of philosophos. Then, as the oration goes on, and presumably we're all dumbfounded to hear Themistius say he's not a philosopher, he offers 6 criteria, or touchstones, by which a true philosopher could be distinguished, if one really wanted to go looking for a philosopher. And I've just summarized these as text 7 on the handout. The true philosopher is usually, not necessarily always, of good ancestry, which is a nice play on his father's name, Eugenius. Second, genuinely possesses knowledge of eternal truths, sort of eternal, non-contingent facts of the kind that Nous contemplates, and is capable of acting on that knowledge. Third, the genuine philosopher is social and free of envy. Fourth, the genuine philosopher loves truth and hates falsehood. And fifth, the genuine philosopher is not a lover of gain. And finally, the genuine philosopher is not a slanderer. Themistius gallops across a field of praeteritio, leaving it to his audience to observe that the speaker in his modesty meets every one of his own criteria, while his accusers fail spectacularly, not least on the final criterion, unwillingness to slander, which is how we got into this whole pickle in the first place. But his real rebuttal is almost an afterthought in passing, as he cites the authority of Plato to demonstrate the consistency of his current behavior, filling theaters, with the paradigmatic philosopher, and this is text 8 on the handout, from the same speech. When the wise Plato spoke in the Piraeus, he says, people streamed into that place and congregated there, and they came not only from the city, but also from the fields and vineyards and silver mines. Yet this did not prevent Plato from becoming wise. In Oration 26, addressed to a few discriminating men, again emphrones, some of whom would evidently consider themselves philosophers, Themistius is happy to downgrade the importance of that theater crowd. He also acknowledges that the philosopher will sometimes need persuasive rhetoric to present his views to the public attractively, and he vigorously defends his right as a philosopher to do so. Socrates, he says, spoke to anyone at all. Plato and Aristotle wrote for the public. And even if speaking to the public was somehow an innovation, that doesn't necessarily make it bad, or a betrayal of philosophy, because some innovations are good. He even mentions logic, which Aristotle, sort of as a formal discipline, seems to have originated. Thus, in text 9, what about the excellent Socrates? He was the first one who considered and posed these questions. What should the basis of moral excellence, or arete, be? What is virtue in a human being, and how may it be achieved? What is vice, and how may one avoid it? He was even more forward in that he did not speak about these issues confidentially and to his pupils alone, but to everyone without reserve, in banks, workshops, and wrestling schools. And this is set against the accusation that Themistius, in some way by gathering audiences or speaking to the public, is betraying that classic sort of 4th century image of the philosopher. Oration 34 offers a particularly rich account of the history of philosophy, which stresses the pedigree leading to Themistius himself, and this is text 10. After mentioning Socrates again, he goes on to describe the divine Plato, who, since he had such a noble nature and was a man of such majesty, was the first to adorn philosophy with its many embellishments. There's a bit of an interesting tension as he describes Plato here, I think, which I'll come back to in the last part of the text. On the one hand, there's Socrates' genuine chorus that's concerned only with ethical matters, only with the public good of the polity. When Plato comes along and does this sort of contemplation, starts to get into natural philosophy and what lies beyond the heavens, well, that still counts, but in a way there's a bit of tension because it looks like this is an embellishment, this is a bit of an extra. So I'll come back to that towards the end. So after describing these embellishments that Plato added and saying Plato advanced even further, going beyond the bounds of the heavens themselves, he stresses that even though Plato did all that, went into all that, his purpose was not to reveal a superfluous realm that contributes nothing to this polity of ours. Quite the contrary, It's a very distinctive feature of Plato's penetrating mind that he links human good to the divine good, and fashions the human polity as much as possible with reference to the polity of the all. And he goes on to say that Aristotle's the same way. He might have a little more curiosity. He might get into the details a little more, the trees as well as the forest. But still, there's no part of his philosophical project and system that neglects the question of the human good. And then, of course, not to leave out our most godlike emperor, a follower of those famous men, who brought philosophy, which was cooped up at home for some time, I think this is Theodosius, by the way, out into our ancestral arena of public conflicts. Plato's, he says, was a vision of political power and philosophy coming together, not of good judgment and secular authority going their separate ways. So again, here he's very neatly suggesting by implication that anyone who is criticizing him for accepting public office, the subject of Oration 34, is really attacking the whole concept of publicly engaged, politically active philosophy. This also implies that there's nothing amiss about Themistius' own behavior. Even his acceptance of honors and rewards, he has to add, is in keeping with the Platonic model of the statesmanly philosopher. Back in Oration 31, which is text 11 on the handout, which is absolutely delightful, he says this, "Perhaps it's good for you to remember the most important of those good deeds of mine, while I myself let them slip from my mind. I did graciously accept, both from you and from the emperors, appropriate honors, prizes of a sort, for all my services. I did this, though, not for my own sake, nor to better myself, but because I had in mind what Plato says, and I wanted many of your fellow citizens to perform similar services for you. For what is honored, Plato says, is always practiced, and what is not honored is disregarded. For this reason, I did not put up a fight about those two bronze statues. I did not resist when the emperor thought that I should ride beside him in his chariot, nor when he gave me the much-discussed tablets of office. I conceded that emperors could bestow such honors on philosophers, but I did not completely transfer or reassign my time from greater to lesser concerns, that is, from philosophy." And when contemporaries accused Themistius in his acceptance of the urban prefecture of descending from philosophy and casting her down, which incidentally is captured by a lovely little epigram that's attributed to Palladius of Alexandria, which is text 12, supposedly addressed to Themistius, "Come and ascend to the depths, for now you have descended to the heights." Yes, yes, it's very nice, but it's all wrong. Themistius' reply is simple and rather eloquent. He manages, first of all, to make a co-conspirator of the emperor, and then again reframes the opposing sides of the debate. What's at issue here again is, of course, two rival conceptions of philosophy, one private, having to do only with words or logoi, and the other public, having to do with deeds or erga. So in text 13, which is also from Oration 34, speaking to Theodosius, who's bestowed office upon him, he writes, "In bringing philosophy from the sphere of words or logoi to that of deeds or erga, we have either both lifted her up or both cast her down." So much for the shield, or Themistius' defense, this positive reframing of what public philosophy is, and the suggestion that any attack on him is really an attack on philosophers who care for the public good. What about the offensive? What about the sword? As the last passages stress, Themistius distinguishes these two kinds of philosophy, one having to do mainly with words and the other with deeds. What does he have to say about the former kind, the sort that has to do just with words, which he implies is the business of his accusers? First of all, it keeps to itself, and it tends to hold its head very high. So in text 14, we have an example of this in Oration 28. "As for the descendants of Socrates," he says, "in our day they have vanished and become non-entities, understandably and deservedly so. For they are fearful, I know not why, and wary of public assemblies, and they cannot bear to look away from their couches and secluded corners." This sounds a little like the mission statement of the new American Philosophical Association Committee on Public Philosophy, by the way. "They believe and assure others that the praise they themselves bestow on a person really belongs to him." That is, they say that only their praise really counts. Again, at Oration 26, where he's addressing a fairly cultured crowd, he says, and this is text 15, "Let us imagine, by the gods, that the city should learn that philosophy does not value keeping company with the general public. Noble woman," the city would say, here addressing a personified philosophy, "how will you still be able to get annoyed with us if you're considered useless in the lives of human beings? How will you continue to be able to insist that those who have no experience of you are to blame for your uselessness, and not you yourself? How can you abandon us when you yourself are unwilling to hold office? You even begrudge us the one thing you could easily give, that is, your words, your logoi. And you do not permit us to share in it en masse. Instead, you're always looking for walls and defenses behind which to hide out against the storm and the dust cloud. This is a nice allusion to a line in Republic 9, I think, where Socrates mentions that the philosopher will take refuge behind a little wall or a tacheon, living in a constitution that might not be suitable to philosophy. And you do not protect us or defend us as you can. It's very often suggested that in making these kinds of remarks, Themistius targeted contemporary Neoplatonism, especially the kind of Neoplatonism practiced by Iamblichus of Chalcis. After all, there's a very familiar commonplace that Neoplatonists in the wake of Plotinus locate primary value in contemplation, theoria. So if they were in Oxford tutorials, they got the tutorial on Nicomachean Ethics 10, but they missed the one on Nicomachean Ethics 1 and the function argument. They're all about theoria in preference to political action. Themistius himself, of course, acknowledges that contemplative happiness as indispensable for the philosophical life. In Oration 21, he stresses, taking Plato as his exemplar, that kind of knowledge of eternal truths is critical for a philosopher, but he also stresses there that even that contemplation has to have good social ends. Also by the 4th century, there seems to have been a developing appetite for the kind of Neoplatonic thought that's embodied by Iamblichus, celebrated, for example, by Eunapius in his Lives of the Sophists. Not only a virtuous person and wise man, and a contemplator, this pagan holy man, is capable of miracles and communication with the gods for good ends, the practices that are loosely collected under the title of theurgy. And this Neoplatonic figure is also prepared to go into retreat, into the peripheries of society, which seems like a far cry from the public-spirited guardian of Paideia that Themistius himself strives to exemplify. And for an example of this view, I've given a passage from Robert Pinella's excellent treatment of Themistius' private orations. This is text 16 of the handout. The other part of Themistius' problem in Oration 26, he says, are philosophers who shun the public and thereby, in Themistius' view, discredit philosophy. Themistius is thinking mainly here of contemporary Neoplatonists who tended to retreat from the world. Or again, Oration 28, which I suspect has been preserved only in part, also criticizes contemporary philosophers, again, surely, Neoplatonists. And again, in Peter Heather's excellent discussion of several political orations and of Constantius's letter to the Senate, and this is passage 17 on the handout, Themistius's philosophical program both implicitly and explicitly set itself up in direct opposition to the Neoplatonic holy man. Among the extant fragments of his philosophical speeches are attacks on those who called themselves philosophers, but had no interest in practical matters, hiding themselves away with just a few devotees, particularly young men whom they sought to attract away from their normal social duties and ties. And this interpretation that I've given Pinella and Heather as examples of, 16 and 17, has very natural grounds, or very good reasons for it. And for one, of course, the Neoplatonic holy man was making considerable strides, it seems, as an alternative philosophical ideal in the 4th century, and Neoplatonism, so far as we can sort of periodize a movement of Neoplatonism, certainly does countenance a certain social disengagement. Already in Porphyry's Life of Plotinus, for example, we find one of Plotinus's students, the senator Rogatianus, engaging in an apostrophe to biu, a sort of turning away from life, giving up public life for the higher or more divine contemplation of nous. Porphyry's Life of Plotinus.
Oh, I see. It's Porphyry's Life.
Yes, sorry.
Thank you very much.
Themistius does seem to have socially disengaged philosophers in his sights in the orations. During the last decade, of course, several scholars like Dominic O'Mara, in his book Platonopolis, have done a lot to undermine the traditional caricature of Neoplatonists as disinterested in practical action or disengaged in public life, and we'll come to that a little later. But here, really, we're interested in whether it was a fair caricature for Themistius to target. More particularly, too, we know that Themistius had limited fortunes in the court of Julian, which was dominated by Maximus, theurgist and pupil of Iamblichus, although it has recently been argued that there was no substantial rift between Themistius and Julian. But Themistius's advice to Julian to engage in public works projects, which was not happily received, could also be read as advice to be less of a contemplative Neoplatonist, to get on with building bridges. While there's nothing explicitly to suggest that Themistius was thinking in such sectarian terms, he was certainly more successful in the courts of Julian's predecessor and successors, and perhaps he had some reason to see his model of philosophy as opposed to the theurgists. Themistius doesn't say anything really directly about this, but he does show awareness, so to speak, of a new game in town. In text 18, for example, from Oration 23, he describes a student of Iamblichus as follows. At that time, that is, in my youth, there lived in Sicyon a man who, of all the Greeks of my time, I would say was most truly and genuinely in possession of philosophy. He had been a disciple of the man of Chalcis, that is, Iamblichus, when the latter was elderly. He was not, however, a devotee of the new song, but of the ancestral and ancient song of the Academy and Lyceum. So it's possible to see a sort of sectarian division between the kind of philosophy that Themistius thinks has the stamp of tradition and something newer deriving from Iamblichus. But I'd like to venture an alternative here. I think it's noteworthy that Themistius does not take the opportunity to associate the characteristics of the Iamblichians with the stay-at-home characteristics of the philosophers who he's usually trying to criticize in the orations. And as a matter of fact, I haven't yet been able to find any evidence to suggest a similarity between the former and latter group, though some of you may help me here. When Themistius does directly criticize the quietist philosophers, and I'll just use this label quietist for the time being, he really says nothing to suggest people with a sort of ritual interest or with a particularly highfalutin view of metaphysics, or again, I think, people who are particularly associated with any public or private features that especially suggest Neoplatonism or the Iamblichians. So if we consider what these quietist philosophers are like in the orations and how they're described, I think we get quite a clear and fairly consistent picture. If we look at Oration 21, for instance, which is text 19 on the handout, we get this. Suppose someone goes about in your city, adulterating, dishonoring, and hawking the most divine of human blessings, that is, philosophy. And this is a description of the kind of philosophers who Themistius takes to be opposed to him. Suppose this person claims a privileged position and regards himself as a human being in the midst of a herd of cattle because he knows, or does not know, about things equivocally named, ta homonyma, and what the difference is between the why and the how, and other such truly obscure and ambiguous terms in Aristotelian logic. Greek is things like kathoti and dioti and hoti. This kind of philosophy, then, has primarily to do with words and logic, at least in its public image. It's idle and inactive, and it concerns itself excessively with hair-splitting. Again, when Themistius tries to stress the high moral quality of his students, he uses the following language from Aristotle's Logic, again, especially the categories, and chapter 1 of the categories is the source of this talk about ta homonyma, or the equivocally named. So in text 20 from Oration 23, have you heard any of those who associate with me boastfully and pretentiously carrying on about things univocally named, synonymois, or equivocally named, homonymois, or derivatively named, paronymois? I take this a little personally since I spend a lot of time reading the categories. But again, Oration 34, text 21 on the handout. This emperor then needed no help in challenging me to pursue virtue, and I do not mean a virtue that's idle and inactive and explicates the meaning of words and logical propositions, but one that daily spurs us on to action, and so on. From the sheer frequency of occurrences, I think the most publicly visible or recognizable feature of the kind of philosophy that Themistius wants to evoke from his hearers in his counter-criticism is really the jargon of Aristotelian logic. The image of these philosophers, apparently, who just can't get out of categories chapter 1, it is difficult, I can totally sympathize with that too, as technical, abstruse sorts of people is also supported by a number of other fragments, I think, which do get beyond Aristotelian logic, but again, I don't think really suggest anything especially Neoplatonic. Consider, for example, the fragment of what Pinella calls the knowledge of knowledges speech that comes down to us at the end of Oration 23, though it might not really belong there. Themistius suggests here that a kind of higher order knowledge exists beyond the first order knowledge of particular sort of day-to-day affairs and technai or arts. But, and this is a very Aristotelian line, it's not a particular specific kind of knowledge like mathematics or technai, but instead it's a proper sort of art of arts, the politike technai really that he and Aristotle regard as the politikos' work. And this is text 22 on the handout. When he says that there's a higher kind of knowledge, he says we don't mean that there's something that considers it important to consort with angles or become absorbed in numbers and so on, but instead a kind of knowledge that presides over the others and tries to explain how they should approach problems, and especially, coming down to the end of the excerpt, which points to the Politics, Book 3, Chapter 6, whether a given art will benefit a correctly ordered polity or is harmful and dangerous. So that's the kind of knowledge, that sort of second-order knowledge that Themistius suggests is particularly valuable to philosophers, but when he's criticizing different views of this higher order knowledge, he's not suggesting something especially metaphysical, I take it. But again, sort of people who are a little overly absorbed in mathematics or the special subjects, like his critique of the logic choppers earlier. He also thinks of natural philosophers in the same sort of vein. So in Oration 26, and this is item 23 on the handout, again, the city, speaking to a personified philosophy, stresses that we don't ask you to explain why the heavens move in the direction they do, or we don't ask you to do meteorology, why is there thunder, lightning, winds, and rain, and so on. Instead, we want to talk about what's good and bad for the city. Again, I think, at least my impression is that the most visible example of all of these, what comes up the most, and therefore might have been the most publicly visible, is this talk about logic, the jargon of Aristotelian logic that seems to have singled out a community, really the community of professional philosophers who have their own language. And this talk about the special subjects falls into the same rubric. But again, I think this would be an odd way to suggest, however implicitly, Neoplatonists of an Iamblichean or other persuasion. Moreover, one other point, I think, against that identification, as natural as it otherwise seems, is that Neoplatonists don't really seem to have been, at least visibly, less publicly engaged than anyone else. Extracts survive from a number of public letters by Iamblichus himself addressed to high-ranking officials. Just in 2013, I think there's an excellent study of these by Swain. Sopater of Apamea, who was the son of Iamblichus's favored pupil, also named Sopater, wrote a surviving letter to his brother Hemerius on the occasion of Hemerius's appointment as governor, which is very similar to Themistius's letter to Julian and opens a window, as Swain put it, on the common Neoplatonic political thinking behind both. Sopater Sr. advised Constantine, though that didn't work out so well for him. Later on, even under riskier circumstances, Proclus got involved to a certain degree in public life in Athens. Admittedly, there may have been a caricature of Neoplatonists as politically inactive, but I don't know if there's a great deal of evidence for that. And I don't think, again, that there's anything to suggest that this is the caricature to which Themistius is pointing here by drawing attention to this use of jargon by secluded logic choppers. There could be some reason to suppose that Themistius, despite all of this, didn't really regard Iamblichean or Neoplatonist efforts at philosophy as particularly philosophical. So, for example, if we move to the public orations and consider Oration 5 addressed to Jovian, after Julian's reign has ended and Themistius is again in favor at court, he credits Julian with restoring philosophy, and this is text 24 on the handout. But I, your majesty, must take thought still more to giving you in return a gift of thanks which is not entirely inadequate, because you are restoring philosophy, which does not much prosper among the masses at this present moment, to the palace once more. And she stands near to you with a more favored aspect. This is after Maximus, who happened to be a Iamblichean Neoplatonist, had left the court, no longer advising the emperor since Julian had been killed and deposed. And then he goes on to cite a number of excellent predecessors and suggest that the emperor follows in all of these past kings' footsteps. And then he says, in return for being publicly honored in this way, philosophy for her part publicly returns these offerings of thanks. Again, the logos ergon division is played on here when he says, words that are sufficient to escort deeds through times and attach everlasting memory to things which pass away, together with seasonable advice and free speech. So this could be a suggestion that real philosophy has come back into play after this Iamblichean mumbo-jumbo has been cast out. But it is worth remembering that there's nothing explicit about this here, and Themistius often designates himself by the abstract noun philosophy, as in Orations 5, 6, and 34, as well as the style of public philosophy that he endorses. What he probably means is that he has come back to court. Philosophy returns when Themistius personally returns from exile in 363-4. And all of this reads very much like Oration 2, where Themistius finishes by congratulating Constantius on appointing a philosopher, incidentally Julian, as Caesar. So I don't think there's anything especially sectarian about this oration in the sense that Themistius is celebrating the departure of Maximus because he was a Neoplatonist of a particular persuasion. One could be forgiven for thinking that Maximus's chief failing was failing to be Themistius. That says nothing about the converse perspective, though. Julian and Maximus very likely did see Themistius as a lighter weight philosopher, but that's not directly to the point here. So coming to the last section and concluding, If we recognize that Themistius's rhetorical foes in the oration, these critics who are also the objects of his criticism, are not necessarily iamblici and Neoplatonists, as is often supposed, then at least two new questions emerge. One, who were they? And second, even more briefly, though it's a very large question and gets us a little bit up the mountain from the plains, what in fact was Themistius's attitude to the most salient features of philosophical Neoplatonism and its picture of philosophical virtue? I don't have a positive proposal for the historical identity of Themistius's logic-chopping, hair-splitting, specializing quietists, and I don't think one is especially needed. I think they're simply the shadow or the necessary contrary of Themistius's carefully constructed identity as a philosopher actively engaged in public life. That view has to cast a shadow, which is the philosopher who isn't. They are characterized to make his professional behavior look moderate and his critics' demeanor look extreme. They're really just professional philosophers. They have their own jargon, their own way of speaking, who do not engage in public life. And they're made to look the worse for it. The classic distinction between logos and ergon, or word and deed, is leveraged to their rhetorical disadvantage. But perhaps a small additional speculation might be worthwhile on this score, because what's a talk without speculation, even if it is recorded? Themistius several times characterizes these non-contributing philosophers as constantly puttering on about equivocal, univocal, and paronymous predication. That is, somehow obsessed with the jargon of Aristotle's logic, and especially with chapter one of the categories. But this close attention to logoi or words on their part is not borne out by virtue in deeds, or erga. About a century earlier, Lucian's Life of Demonax has the Cynic philosopher Demonax making jokes at the expense of Herminus, the Aristotelian who taught Alexander of Aphrodisias and was apparently famous or infamous for his obsession with Aristotle's categories. This is text 25 on the handout. Demonax's remark to Herminus the Aristotelian is worth recording. He was aware that this man's character was vile and his misdeeds innumerable, while his mouth was always full of Aristotle and his ten categoriae. "Certainly, Herminus," he said, "you deserve ten categoriae," which is a brilliant pun between the two senses of categoriae as predication and a legal charge. This passage might stem from some broader anecdotal tradition that's also represented by Themistius's comments on philosophers who happen to have a strong and loud devotion to Aristotelian logic but little grasp of virtue in their lives. It might be a sort of common caricature. In public view, it might be a little like an impression of analytic philosophers who do a lot of logic chopping but little good, or worse, have poor ethics themselves. And to stretch the speculation even a little further, the anecdotes about Demonax do seem to represent a tradition of sympathy with cynicism, and I think Themistius may have drawn on some cynic role models in his De Virtute surviving in Syriac, but Alberto could correct me about that when we get the time. Let me just close by exploring then a more positive point about Themistius' relationship to Neoplatonism more broadly conceived, having gone through this broader survey of his depiction of an ideal philosopher. A pretty clear distinction has often, and I think justly, been drawn between Themistius's broad philosophical outlook, particularly in the Aristotelian paraphrases, and the intellectual thrust of the movement that we date from Plotinus. If it's right to doubt that the Neoplatonists are Themistius's primary rhetorical target as competitors in the orations, then there might be a little less motivation to read his philosophical views in a sectarian light. Some commentators once even characterized Themistius, especially his father Eugenius, as a kind of Neoplatonist himself, and it's true that there are important Plotinian parallels in the paraphrases, particularly when Themistius talks about the active intellect, the anima 3.5, and uses metaphors of illumination to describe it, but these have probably been overemphasized in those cases, and I don't mean to make particularly heavy weather of them here. But from the social point of view that I've tried to explore here, once we do let go of the idea that Themistius was going after these Neoplatonists who avoided public life, I think there are two familiar and still frequently cited points of contrast between philosophers of a Neoplatonist persuasion and Themistius. First, one is that, like them, Themistius wants to harmonize the views of Plato and Aristotle, but unlike them, Themistius prefers Aristotle. And while the Neoplatonists recognize Aristotle as subordinate or propaedeutic to Plato, whose wisdom sometimes is characterized as a kind of divine inspiration or madness, they think that Plato goes beyond Aristotle. Secondly, Themistius emphasizes practical or public life again and again, where the Neoplatonists primarily value transcendence of and freedom from the world, achieved through contemplation or perhaps through theurgy. Like Socrates' philosopher Theaetetus 176b, They want flight from the troubles of this world and likeness to God. Now, I think there is a bit of tension in Themistius' orations, at least on each of these points. Like his father, as is often pointed out, Themistius is particularly fond of Aristotle. Aristotle is his favorite. But then again, Themistius says this when he remarks on his father's subscription to the harmonization program between Aristotle and Plato. This is text 26 on the handout. To be sure, the visage and shape impressed upon these sacred mysteries were almost entirely those of Aristotle. Nevertheless, my father helped to open up all the shrines of the sages. For he, my father, Eugenius, felt that Aristotle's philosophy is an excellent preliminary right to Plato's frenzy, and at the same time a defensive wall and safeguard for it. The tension here is implicit, I think. Eugenius, like Themistius, is particularly delighted by Aristotle, but sees him as preliminary, at least in a pedagogical way, to Plato, which sounds suspiciously like the standard Neoplatonist view. Arguably, if there is a particular sectarian position here, it's the view, normative from a post-Platonian standpoint, that the study of Aristotle supports and precedes the study of Plato. But Eugenius and Themistius' delight in Aristotle is individual. It's promoted as distinct from that standard position, but that standard position is not rejected along the way. Perhaps it's like saying, to be sure, I much prefer digestive biscuits to steamed vegetables. Nonetheless, I feel like digestive biscuits are an excellent preliminary to steamed vegetables, and I shall have them first. What about the second point, the high value placed on contemplation by the Neoplatonists? Well, Themistius' paraphrase of Aristotle's De Anima uses a number of Plotinian metaphors to describe the activity of active intellect or nous, some of which Franz de Haas was telling us about last week, as it penetrates eternal, non-contingent truths, though this shows nothing in particular, I think, except that Themistius and Eugenius knew either their Plotinus or a common source. He does seem closer to Plotinus than Alexander of Aphrodisias, at least. I've given an example of that language and those metaphors in text 27 on the handout. But when Themistius praises the philosopher's knowledge of eternal truths and Plato's stretching beyond nature to the contemplation of the divine, he also concludes that this higher contemplation naturally leads to good action in the polity. And this was back in T10 on the handout when he was describing what Plato achieved. Just to remind you of a little bit, he says, Plato dared to investigate whether there isn't something higher than nature herself. His purpose was not to reveal a superfluous realm that contributes nothing to this polity of ours. Quite the contrary, it's a very distinctive feature of Plato's penetrating mind that he links human to divine good and fashions the human polity as much as possible with reference to the polity of the all. In terms of what the Neoplatonists called the scale or ladder of virtues, this is a pretty clear story. Plato achieved the heights of contemplative virtue, grasping eternal truths, but he also reflected that achievement in practice, mirroring that grasp of intellect in political affairs. Themistius also makes rather similar remarks about emperors. Constantius, for example, is a king who fashions his own soul into the likeness of God, achieves the goal of homoiosis to Theo, and then acts accordingly in guiding the polity. That's in Oration 1. With the spirit of this applied to the philosopher or to Plato, Plotinus might broadly agree. He too suggests that praxis is an image of theoria, in a sense, and the sage of higher virtue will also necessarily have the lower virtues. Text 28 on the handout is a very brief summary of the Neoplatonic scale of virtues. Richard has very helpfully collected almost all of the relevant texts for this in one of the source books, which I've cited here. Numbers 3 through 6, incidentally, are those that Porphyry develops in a passage of his sentences, which is more or less a commentary on Plotinus Ennead 1-2. It basically runs in its later form natural virtue. Porphyry doesn't have so much to say about this, but this is, in Aristotle's terms, in the Nicomachean Ethics, the sort of thing that's shared with children and beasts. A cheetah is fast, for example, doesn't have to do anything to get there. It's just arete you get for free. Second, habituated virtue, which does require a certain sort of habituation or good upbringing in the language of the Ethics. Then what the Neoplatonists regarded as the philosophically trained virtues, 3 through 6. First, civic virtue, sort of good behavior, good action in the polis. And then working one's way up to contemplative virtue, 5. And finally, although this isn't in Porphyry, but it looks like it was introduced by Iamblichus, 7, the hieratic or priestly kind of virtue. So just focusing on 3 to 6, which were present for Porphyry, and at least were present in seed or dunamé for Plotinus, we can look at passages like Plotinus's Enneads 1-3-6, which is 29 on the handout, or Porphyry 30 on the handout, stressing that the lower kinds of virtue won't exist without the higher, but the higher kinds of virtue will necessarily require the possession of the lower. So just like Plato's example in Themistius, one can have contemplative virtue, but that implies by necessity or entails that one's actions in the world will be good and one will benefit the polis. So from these vantage points, when Themistius declares himself a politikos or a public philosopher, it doesn't necessarily imply, if he did have this sort of notion in mind, that he sets contemplation off limits, nor for that matter in a purely Aristotelian framework, despite the tension between ethics, Nicomachean Ethics 1 and 10, does he necessarily set up such an opposition. The contemplative philosopher can still do good in public life, Plato did, and the emperor does. I also don't think, again, there's any reason to see this as some sort of dig necessarily against the followers of Plotinus and Iamblichus, as many of them were active in public life. So all of this is not to say, by the way, that Themistius is a Neoplatonist or really to claim anything in particular about his views concerning, say, Plotinus. I only want to suggest that the markers of school identity are not necessarily so clearly important to Themistius as would naturally seem to be the case if we were reading his philosophical works through the lens of the Orations and supposing that the Quietists are Neoplatonists. So it would be useful to keep these matters separate when considering Themistius' intellectual affiliations, perhaps. It does seem rather likely to me that Themistius did not see different schools of philosophy as so different in reality in the sense that public-minded philosophers or private-minded corner-hiding philosophers could come from any particular school, possibly excepting the Epicureans, which is why they're literally left in the corner. That's also not to deny that there are multiple paradigms of the late antique philosopher on offer, and that Themistius does choose between them. He opts to fashion his public identity after the civic or Socratic image of the master of Hellenic Paideia. He does not opt for the image of the holy man that Iamblichus and Maximus choose, nor again for the Christian faithful aesthetic, the type of Antony the Great, without Paideia but full of power and persuasion, who would eventually challenge the pagan philosopher for social prestige at the emperor's court. But Themistius' self-fashioning after the first of these, the Trebonion-wearing, staff-wielding, truth-telling, humble philosopher who will best represent the Hellenic elites of Constantinople while reserving a dignified impartiality on matters of religious identity, deserves to be recognized as a great success, possibly the last great success of that ancient archetype writ large against the twilight of the Eastern Empire. Thank you very much.
Thank you.